on the floor. Philba lurched forward, drawing more and more of his bulk upright until it seemed impossible that he could maintain his balance. He swayed, a mottled tower of flab and slime, then toppled, crashing down to the floor. Blade bent over the motionless form. He touched the hut's back, perhaps feeling for some kind of pulse. Then he turned to the broken ale jug, lifted a shard, and sniffed it. A peculiar expression spread over his face, equal parts understanding, anger, and bafflement. He stood frozen for a moment, then hurled the fragment to break against the wall. The entrance chime activated. A muffled pounding was heard, as were concerned shouts. Philba's collapse had probably been noticed by everyone in the area. Dan would not have been surprised if the Separatists hadn't felt it as well. Blade turned to the door. He smoothed his uniform, made sure no metal hung even slightly askew, and then opened it. Dan knew it was time to go. The Moon Moth was immune to most detection devices, but shortly, Tex would likely be going over this chamber with gadgets that could hear an electron shifting shells. He made the Moon Moth fly off the shelf toward the entrance, which was already filled with confused and shocked faces. A hand came out of nowhere, moving so fast it just seemed to appear. Dan gasped as his point of view shifted violently, and then, suddenly, the Moon Moth was being held close to Blade's face. The Admiral was staring, it seemed, right into Den's eyes. A second later, the hand closed into a fist. There was a flash as the piezoelectric shorted out, and then blackness. It was, other than Philba's demise, a quiet day. There was a lull in the fighting, and no medlifters arrived bearing wounded, a welcome rarity. The activity around Philba's death was exciting enough. The Plithvine carried rumors everywhere. As Barriss made her medical rounds in the ward, even the patients knew about it. She overheard the Ugnaughts gossiping.
"Yar, the hut drank poison. Suicide for sure. He beat a spy. It war Philba who bloated the Bota transport. No lie, blood. They were closing in on him. He saw it coming."
Hadn't Admiral Blade himself gone to see the hut just before Philba had croaked? No doubt, it had been to question him about his activities.
"He was also stealing Bota, didn't you know? That little reporter, Durr. He was on the hut like sleeks on swamp scum, nosing around, building a case, and Philba was on the verge of being arrested, and he had taken the poison to avoid being court-martialed and executed," and so on.
Barriss didn't add to the gossip. She just listened as she went about her duties. If the suicide rumor was true, then it might mean she would be leaving Drongar soon. Her mission to find out who had been stealing Bota would be over, if it truly had been the hut. And from the talk, it seemed it had. How many thieves, after all, were likely to be operating at the same time in a small outfit like this? The day faded into evening, and eventually Barriss was finished with her medical chores. She decided to skip dinner and go to her cubicle. The camp was quiet as night crept over it. Few people were about. Shift change was long past, and most were either eating supper or resting or doing whatever it was they did when they weren't working. As Barriss neared the mouth of the alley that led to her quarters, she felt a presence in the shadows. She saw no one, but the force's prompt was clear and unmistakable, almost the psychic equivalent of a hand on her shoulder. She stopped. Her hand moved slowly toward her lightsaber.
"You won't need that," a voice said. "I'm not going to do you any real harm. Just teach you a little lesson in humility. You Jedi are big on that, aren't you?" Foe Jai.
She still couldn't see him, but she knew where he was. Just over there, in the dark shadow of a quiet power generator a few meters to her right. "What makes you think you are the person to give lessons in humility?" Foe Jai glided from the darkness. "Those who can, do. Those who can't, don't." "Very succinct. What do you want?"
"Like I said, a lesson is required. The last time we chatted, you tripped me.
from behind. I owe you a return of the favor. I think a mud bath is only fair. Nothing serious, no broken bones or anything. This is an exercise in reciprocity, nothing more. If your force can stop me, then by all means.
He held his arms wide in a beckoning gesture.
Use it.
Jai settled into a stance, legs planted low and wide. He raised his hands, beckoned with one in a flippant gesture.
Come, Jedi. Shall we dance a little?
Barriss tried to control herself.
I shouldn't be doing this. I should refuse and walk away. Let him think I'm afraid. What does it matter? But he should respect the Jedi.
Even if he didn't respect her. It sat poorly with her to hear the name of her order coded with contempt. She stayed where she was. Jai smiled.
Good move. You don't want to be committed one way or the other when facing a skilled opponent.
He circled to his right, and Barriss moved away from him, maintaining a wary distance. The temptation to reach for the Force, to use it to flatten Jai, was almost overwhelming. She had no doubt she could do it. One gesture, and Jai would fly into the nearest tree like a rabid rock bat. No fighter, no matter what his physical strength, could pit muscle against the Force and prevail. She would win the battle if she did it. But she knew she might lose the war. To use the Force against an opponent when you were in no real danger was wrong. She had been taught so all her life. The Force was not something to spend like a token in a sweet shop simply because you could. Neither was it solely a weapon. So what was left? Her own fighting skills. These were not inconsiderable. Jedi were trained in all manner of disciplines, both mental and physical, and the Masters knew there were times when use of the Force was not appropriate. Even without activating her lightsaber, she was someone to be reckoned with. He leapt, covering the two strides separating them with phenomenal speed. Barriss barely had enough time to dodge, twist to her left, and block, so that his punch glanced off her shoulder instead of connecting with her solar plexus. She backed away, keeping her guard up.
Excellent, he said. You have very good reflexes, but you should have counterattacked. Pure defense is a losing strategy.
Jai circled the opposite way, moving his hands up and down and around in an almost hypnotic weave, trying to draw her attention. He came in again, and this time, instead of moving out of his path, Barriss slid forward to meet him. But she dropped very low, below his center of gravity, firing a hard punch at his belly as his strike sailed over her head. She hit him, but it was like punching a wall. There was no give. His abdominals were like ridged plasteel. She scooted out of range as fast as she could, but not fast enough. She caught a slap on the left side of her neck as she retreated, hard enough to make her vision flare red for an instant. She gained two steps away, and he turned to face her again.
Very good, Padawan. Not the best target, but a clean strike. You'll need more than one, though. Think combinations. High-low, multiple attacks.
Her neck stung, but the pain was small and no damage done. The Force sang within her, and she could barely keep from using its power. The dark side was always there, her master had told her, always waiting for an opportunity to be set loose. Given once, it would be twice as powerful the next time. Given again, and you might be lost forever. Oh, but she wanted to show him, wanted to knock that gloating smirk from his face and replace it with awe, with amazement, with fear. Too much thinking, she realized too late. Jai leapt in again, and in a fast series of open-hand techniques, slapped her head, her torso, and her hip. The last hit was coupled with a foot hooked around her ankle. Barriss went down hard, and the wet ground was only a little forgiving as she slammed into it. Whatever might have happened next, as she scrambled back up into a defensive stance, was interrupted by the too familiar drone of lifters arriving. People came boiling out of their quarters, heading for their stations. Those who noticed Jai and Barriss at all spared them little more than a glance.
I think we're done, Jai said. My point has been made.
Barris said nothing. She did not trust herself to. Her rage enveloped her like the mud. She trembled under the weight of it. She could feel the dark side surging within her, whispering to her of how good it would feel, how easy it would be to let her rage fuel it and send it ravening for her enemy. To seize her lightsaber, leap after him, and bisect him with a single downward slash of the singing energy blade. Fo-Jai had no idea how close to dying he was just then. Her rage was such that a flicker of a finger would suffice. He'd never know what hit him, and it would even be justice in a fashion. Was he not, after all, a killer? Yes, he was. But Barris Ophi was not. It was one of the hardest things she'd ever done, but she did it. She resisted the dark side. She lost the battle, but won the war. This time. Dender went where he usually went to work out his problems, the cantina. But even sitting there in the semi-darkness, feeling the damp, sluggish air, reluctantly stirred by the circulators, sliding over him like hot oil, he barely sipped at his drink. Philba was history, and so was Den's story. Nobody wanted to read an expose about a dead hut on a one-rocket planet. As he'd suspected, Blade had been in on whatever skullduggery had been going with Philba. That was a great story, but one he couldn't dare file until he was at least 50 parsecs away. The enmity of angry, crooked, and feral admirals being generally bad for one's health. Still, the stone hidden in the stew was that the admiral knew somebody had seen and heard what had happened just before Philba was shuffled off back to the primordial ooze from whence he'd come. It wasn't the admiral who had poisoned him. Den was fairly sure of that, judging by Blade's reactions. Not that it mattered much, since black marketing during wartime was generally considered treason and was punishable by death. At best, even if Den had all kinds of outstanding favors due him from high places, which he didn't, his career would be ruined if this got out while he was still in the same sector as Blade. At worst, he'd be quietly executed and spaced. The first thing he had done after he saw Blade crush the moon moth was feed the receiver unit into a waste disposal unit that turned it into sludge and piped it off into the swamp with the rest of the sewage slurry. The recording from the cam, a disc the size of his little fingernail, was now glued to the back of a wall brace of the South Refresher, just a handspan above the catalytic tanks. Not a place where anybody would happen across it, and one where, even if by some miracle it was found, it wouldn't be connected to him. He needed the recording to verify his story. But he didn't need Blade finding it and having him shot. The only problem was, this meant Den was going to be stuck here on scenic Drongar for a while. Any sudden move to fire thrusters now would certainly throw the hard glare of suspicion on him. No, he would just have to stick it out. Find another story to justify his being here. Maybe something with Fo-Jai, that fighter who'd slaughtered the mercenaries. It wouldn't be too comfortable to have him irritated at you either, but at least Den could get some protection from the higher-ups, Jai being only a lieutenant. Yeah, that would keep the pot boiling long enough for him to eventually jet this swamp world. Once he was on the other side of the core, then he could bring low the mighty Admiral Blade for his audience. Black Market Admiral revealed. Associate in crime dies mysteriously. Den smiled. He did love a thrilling headline. He took a bigger sip of his drink. Problem raised, problem solved. Another victory for crack reporter Den Durr, speaking to you live from the Jassiric front in the Clone Wars. Though the action was unusual, Admiral Blade found sufficient reason to delay his departure from Rimsu 7 for a few days. He offered as a reason his belief that the matter of the murdered hut needed further investigation and his desire to make certain his people were protected.
The real reason for him staying, of course, was to find the one who had dared to surveil him. Whoever it was, he would soon learn how dangerous it could be to spy on a predator. They erected a command module for him, not much more than a bubble with some basic furniture and comm gear, but it was enough. For someone who had hunted many times on planets where there was nothing to sleep on but the cold, hard ground, a form cot was more than he needed. As he opened the door to his bubble, a spicy floral smell wafted over him. Without even thinking, Blade drew his blaster.
"Move and I'll cook you where you stand," he said.
"I won't move, Admiral, though I'm not standing at the moment."
The voice had a musical and amused lilt to it. Blade passed his free hand in front of the room's lighting control, and the hut's interior lit up, revealing the robed and cowled figure of a Silent. Members of the meditative caste were omnipresent in houses of healing throughout the universe, as their mission was to aid the sick and injured. The Silent took their meals in private and wore their hoods up in public, effectively hiding their identities at all times. The being sitting on Blade's cot was obviously in disguise, since by speaking, he had broken the siblinghood's most sacred tenet.
Blade did not lower the blaster.
"Who are you? What are you doing here?"
"If I may."
The other raised his hands slowly to the sides of his head.
Blade nodded.
"Slowly and with great care."
The figure slipped the cowl back to reveal his face. It was not the countenance of any being Blade had ever seen before, and he had been around the galaxy more than a few times. The face was vaguely bird-like, with sharp violet eyes, a nose and mouth that could have been a short beak, and pale blue skin that might be either extremely fine fur or feathers. Blade could not tell which from where he stood. The head was smooth, the ears flat and set close against the skull, and there was a hint of darker blue at the base of the throat.
"Quite striking," the Admiral thought.
He had certainly seen more unattractive bipeds.
The being smiled. Blade assumed he was a male, and there were at least several pointed teeth in the thin-lipped beak mouth. There was also more than a hint of danger glinting in those eyes. This was a deadly creature, whatever its origins or intentions.
"I am Caird of the Nadiji."
Nadiji? Nadiji? He had heard the name. Ah, yes, he remembered it now.
An avian species from a far-flung world called Nadij, on the east spinward arm.
Blade frowned.
There was something else unusual about them.
What was it? "I didn't realize the Nadiji traveled outside their own system. I seem to recall hearing that such journeying was taboo."
"If one is properly nested, yes, that is true," the Nadiji replied. "But there are some among us who, for one reason or another, cannot be of the flock. No one cares where the wind bears us."
"Well, here, we do care if somebody breaks into our quarters. Explain yourself quickly."
Blade gestured slightly with the blaster. There was a small click behind him, as if someone was trying his closed door. Blade shifted his attention to the sound for a heartbeat. The Nadiji vanished. No, that was not strictly true. The being had moved, but so fast that Blade couldn't believe what he was seeing. Of a moment, he was sitting on the cot, and then in an eye blink, he stood next to Blade, out of the blaster's line of fire, close enough to touch. Blade started to shift his aim, but stopped. If the fellow could move that swiftly in a one-gravity field, he would never be able to line up on him in time if he had a weapon of his own and wanted to use it. He lowered the blaster.
"Wise move, Admiral."
Blade caught a flash of light on something in the Nadiji's hand. Then whatever it was disappeared.
"All right," Blade said. "You've established that you're faster than a dirt demon. Though if I hadn't been distracted by that noise..."
Caird walked back toward the cot, a slow stroll that had definite elements of avian locomotion in it. When he reached it, he turned, flashed his teeth again, and said,
You mean this noise?
The click came again. Blade did not allow it to distract him this time. Caird held up a small device the size of his thumb, the thing that had caught the light a moment before. He had yellowish talons on his fingertips, Blade noticed.
A simple clicker, operated by this remote.
Fine. You came prepared. What do you want?
The continuation of our mutual benefit, Admiral. Apparently, our last agent was careless in his piloting. I am a much better flyer. In the genes, you know.
Blade felt a small but definite surge of fear. Black Sun. He hadn't expected them so soon. Blade's mind flashed to the perfect ruse he had devised for disposing of Mothel's body. First, freezing the body in a block of carbonite. Next, smuggling the carbonite block onboard Mothel's own ship. And lastly, autopiloting the ship over Separatist space, where it was promptly shot down because it didn't have the proper clearances. There was, however, just enough trace molecular residue to establish that an organic body, probably humanoid, had been vaporized along with the ship. Blade quickly wiped his memory, not entirely sure that Nadiji didn't possess telepathic abilities.
Ah, he said. Indeed, Caird said.
As it turned out, Caird was a surprise on more than one level. Apparently, Black Sun did not want to change its former arrangement regarding the Bota. It took Blade but a moment to realize that Mothel had been up to some business of his own. Caird's purpose was to investigate Mothel's death, which he had done to his satisfaction while disguised as one of the Silent, and to assure that the flow of Bota stayed constant. Supply and demand kept the value very high, and moving a small amount of material for a large profit was better than moving large amounts at a lesser rate, which was what Blade had figured all along. So Mothel's real intention had been to grab as much Bota as he could, then flee before his superiors in the criminal organization found out. How interesting. Had Black Sun known what its late agent had been up to, they would likely have taken care of him themselves, Blade realized. He'd done them a favor. But he wasn't about to volunteer how Mothel had met his end. That would be suicide.
I will remain in the camp for a few days, Caird said, pretending to be of the Silent, observing the doctors and patients, so as not to arouse suspicion by leaving too soon. This business with the hut, you're doing?
Blade considered his reply for a moment. If the Nadiji believed he had poisoned Philba, he would give it no more thought.
Yes, he was becoming greedy. I thought it best to remove him before he caused problems.
Wise. We like prudent beings in our partnerships.
The bird being turned toward the door.
We will be in touch, Admiral. Until then, keep following the original plan agreed upon by you and my superiors.
Understood.
Once Caird had gone, Blade felt a sense of relief. The loss of Black Sun's hot breath on his back was one less worry with which he had to deal. The spy was not surprised to see one of the Silent standing in the hard shade next to the medical ward. There hadn't been any assigned to the Rimsu in the last few months. But where there were doctors and suffering, the presence of the Silent was always a possibility. While seeing the Silent there was not a surprise, hearing the whisper from the cowled figure,
"We need to talk, Lens," was startling.
The spy was too well trained to give anything away, and there was no one else around in any event. The code name Lens provided all the information necessary to know what, if not who, the being disguised as a Silent was. The disguise was unexpected and clever. The spy had two code names on this world, one for the Separatists and the second for the underworld organization Black Sun. To the latter, the spy was known as Lens. Anybody who spoke that name aloud could only have gotten it from Black Sun, and they didn't give such information to anybody but their own.
My quarters. 10 minutes. Len said, lips unmoving. When the agent from Black Sun arrived, precisely 10 minutes later, in the cubicle, Lenz was there and ready to deal with him. The cowl lowered. Lenz saw that the face belonged to an Adiji, and that brought a smile.
I am Caird. I understand there was a death in the family here recently.
Lenz nodded. The hut was more useful to us dead than alive. As Black Sun's operative on this world, Lenz had been given information pertaining to their operation here. That included knowing about Philba, the deal he'd had with the Admiral, and the recent loss of the courier sent here to check on the Bota. Caird cocked his head to one side.
You're doing?
Lenz nodded. Of course. Who else? You are aware that I have other duties, and that these do not conflict with my responsibilities to Black Sun. Philba was becoming greedy and erratic. His death was only a matter of time, and by hastening it, a certain measure of protection for my position here was provided.
Interesting, Caird said.
You disapprove?
Not at all. You are here because our organization has trust in your abilities. As long as things get done, how you manage it is not our concern. It's just that I had a chance to speak with our partner here a short while ago, and it is the Admiral's claim that he had the hut rendered inert.
Lenz frowned. Why would he say that?
An excellent question. One I feel I should find the answer to before I leave this world.
Lenz nodded again. And what of my mission?
The same as before. How goes the charting?
Slow but steady. I have locations for all the major Bota fields in this quadrant, many of them in the adjacent quadrants, and several wild patches on the opposite side of the planet that so far have not been officially logged. Nor will they be, unless by accident. I have caused the records to show those locations scanned and found empty of the plant.
Excellent. When the Separatists or the Republic finally triumph, we are prepared to deal with either one regarding the Bota. If there are unknown sources, so much the better.
Joss moved through the medical section on his way to see a post-op patient who had recently developed a nosocomial infection. The patient was a human male officer, not a clone, and one upon whom both he and Zan had worked for several hours to replace a shrapnel-riddled heart. They had been lucky. 5 minutes more, and they would have lost the man. After such a brilliant surgical triumph, losing him to some waist-hopper secondary bug was simply unacceptable. Even though the RIMSU was state-of-the-art in sterile procedure and environment, nosocomial infections, contagions picked up while one was hospitalized, still happened now and then. This particular one had been very stubborn, not responding to the usual broad-spectrum antibiotics, and so far, they had been unable to culture out and identify it. The prognosis was dire. Unless they could ID the cause, the officer wasn't going to survive. When Joss arrived at the isolation chamber, he saw that Zan was already inside the airflow walls and sterile zap field that kept pathogens from entering or escaping. Joss stepped into the field, which crackled slightly. Zan started, as if somebody had poked a finger into his back. He looked around, saw Joss, and relaxed.
Ah, it's you. Nice to see you, too.
Joss noticed that Zan was holding an empty skin popper.
Sorry, just a little on edge.
Joss looked down at the unconscious form in the bed.
How's our latest poster boy for the horrors of war doing?
The patient, one Undo Mitresis, a major in the army, looked somewhat better than the last time Joss had seen him. His skin had been pale and anhydrotic, but now it was taking on a normal, healthy glow. The flat-screen chart hung on the bed's foot, and Joss picked it up and scanned the stats. Blood pressure normal, heart rate normal, white cell blood count.
Hello. Look at this.
The elevated white count had indicated the infection was way down. And the differentials. The spread and proportion of specialized white cells, segs, polys, eos, and so forth were all within normal limits. The patient had turned around.
"Well, well," Joss said. "Looks like somebody has the healing hands of a Jedi. Or the fingers, at least."
The skin around Zan's horns mottled a bit. The Zabrakian equivalent of a human's blush. He dropped the empty skin popper into the pocket of his one piece. Joss frowned.
"You develop a sudden sentimental attachment to instruments? Going to have it anodized and put it on the mantle?"
"Excuse me?
Since when do empty poppers not go into the trash?"
Joss waved at the waste hopper next to the bed.
"Oh, sorry. Guess my brain's gone on leave."
Zan pulled the skin popper out and tossed it into the bin. As it arced past him, Joss got a good look at the pneumatic injector. The clear plastoid cover was just that. Clear. Blank. No identification denoting what kind of medication it had held. No batch number either. Nothing. That simply wasn't done. The patient, who was now awake, mumbled that he was indeed feeling much better. Joss made polite doctor noises, automatically checked the man's vitals, then raised an eyebrow at Zan.
"Dr. Yant, if I might speak with you in private?"
Outside the building, Joss steered Zan into a patch of shade and relative coolness.
"All right, what's going on here?"
"Going on? What are you talking about?"
Zan didn't meet Joss's eyes.
"I'm talking about a patient who comes out of a life-threatening secondary infection so fast he leaves ion burns on his chart. I'm also talking about treatment with unmarked skin poppers."
Zan hesitated for a moment, then sighed in resignation. In that short pause, Joss suddenly knew what had transpired.
"You didn't," he said.
Zan said, "I did."
"Zan, have you got an ingrown horn or something? You know what the risks are. If they catch you, you'll be court-martialed."
"If you see a fellow sentient drowning and there's a rope lying right next to your foot, are you going to worry about being accused of stealing the rope?"
"If there's a good chance they'll hang me with it, yeah. This is not the same thing."
"It isn't? We're on a planet with the biggest supply of a flat-out miracle drug in the galaxy. You can walk to a huge field of it in 5 minutes.
We tried everything else on this guy, Joss. Macromolecular regeneration, nanocell implants, maser cauterization. Nothing worked. The man was dying. You've read the SGJ literature touting Bota. An adaptogen that can cure everything but a rainy day in most humanoid phenotypes. We've had patients who died from infections we probably could have cured with one scale of it.
Can I stand by and let people die without doing everything in my power to save them?"
At a total loss for words, Joss looked at his friend and saw nothing in front of him but a doctor who took his job as seriously as he himself did. He sighed.
"Okay, but you've got to be more careful. There are a lot of sharper eyes than mine around here who could notice a blank skin popper."
Den Durr was not a being to sit idle for long. Despite his facade of being supremely bored and cynical, of doing his job solely because it paid his drink tab, the thing in which he took the most pleasure in his life was his work. Even with the Admiral hunting him, he could not simply camp in his quarters. In fact, he couldn't do that precisely because the Admiral was hunting him. The first question to answer during an investigation, an old police officer had once told him, is, what looks different now than it did before? Any change in the behavior of a criminal suspect was cause for suspicion. So it was that Den Durr found himself out in the blistering hot day, shadowing the Rimsu's combat instructor. Discreetly, very discreetly. It wasn't a real good idea to come to the attention of a being who could, if he wished, exterminate you without even raising his heart rate. A being who had demonstrated his ability and his willingness to snuff out lives and who had been recorded doing it. A being who glorified in the hunt and the kill. A being like Fo Jai.
Den slipped into the shade of an outbuilding, happy for the relative coolness there, and watched his quarry. He focused a tiny recording cam upon the scene and triggered it. A little more background material never hurt. Fogi had assembled a class of combat students, maybe a dozen or so, mostly humans, and they were limbering up their bodies on a patch of pink short grass behind the cantina. Broad-leaved trees offered the martial arts trainees partial shade, but their exertions still had those who shed heat by perspiring, sweating profusely, while those who used other means of cooling themselves were panting, waving their limbs, or expanding rills and bulbi, whatever it took to bleed off excess warmth. The students took a stance, 1 foot forward, one hand high, one low. Jai walked around them, touching an arm or leg here and there, correcting the poses. Everybody in the group watched him with what Den could see, even from his hiding place, was a tense wariness. Den shook his head. This Fogi was a bad man, no doubt about that. He already had enough to file a story, but he allowed the cam to continue running. He knew what his slant was going to be. Fogi, a murderous thug who in peacetime would likely be locked away to protect the citizenry, instead was indulging his violent tendencies on the field of battle, allowed to kill and to be thought a hero and not a villain. How did the public feel about that? Knowing that someone who is mentally deranged and violent, an assassin, a monster, was out there and ostensibly on their side. Den knew he could twirl it so that they would be horrified. A few more sequences showing the humans' cruelty and violence, and civilized beings would turn away in disgust and revulsion. He smiled. This was what he did, and he was good at it. Of course, one could never be sure what the public would do, but he knew a good story when he saw one, and whatever else he might lack in, he could tell that story well. Tulk, Joss decided, was deliberately torturing him. She knew how she affected him. It was in her nature and training both as a species and as a female, and she was doing everything but giving him a handwritten invitation to join her in whatever his heart might desire. In the pre-op surgical scrub room, Joss washed his hands, taking the customary 10 minutes to do so, lathering, cleaning under the short nails, then repeating the process, even though the need for such had been unnecessary since long before he'd been born. With sterile fields and gloves, there was not much of a chance any pathogens were going to be transferred into a patient, because he washed his hands for 9 minutes instead of 10. But he'd been taught by traditionalists who valued the old customs. So he washed, and he watched the chrono, and he brooded. Old customs. On his world, it was acceptable, barely, that a young, unmarried person might go forth into the galaxy and sample the pleasures of extra company. It wasn't spoken of in polite circles, but it was done. Then the young, having gotten it out of their systems, were to return home, find a spouse from a proper Enster family, and settle down. But even in his younger and wilder days, Joss had never been comfortable with the idea of brief liaisons. He'd done it, of course, but the essentially meaningless encounters had weighed heavily upon him. At the core of his being, Joss knew that there would only be one love in his life, and that he should not be unfaithful to her, even if he did so before he ever met her. But now, here was Tulk. Beautiful, sexy, adept, caring, intelligent, and Joss knew, all too perceptive. She called to him. Joss was indeed a man torn. Tulk knew about his cultural background, of course. She could have politely backed away from any possible entanglements, but she hadn't. And why is that, Joss, you simpleton? Joss scrubbed hard at the backs of his fingers. How pink the skin was getting there. Clean, very clean. I wouldn't recommend scrubbing the skin off entirely, Joss. Get serous fluid inside the gloves and all. Speak of temptation, and lo, there did she appear. He mumbled something. Pardon?
I didn't catch that.
He took a deep breath. Might as well get to it. Listen, Tulk. She smiled sweetly at him, pretending he knew that she didn't have a clue as to how he felt.
Yes?
He straightened, stuck his hands under the dryer.
Why are you making this so hard?
Me? I'm sorry, am I making something hard, Dr. Vondar?
You know my culture, he said.
Yes,
and this knowledge disturbs you? Blast it, Tulk. We can't have a future together.
Tulk blinked, as innocent as a newborn.
Future? Who said anything about that?
Tulk.
We're in a war zone, Joss, remember? Our protective field might malfunction tomorrow. We could take incoming fire from the Separatists, and we could all cease to be just like that.
Or the spores could mutate and kill us, or we could be hit by lightning. In short, this is a dangerous place. Prognosis, dismal. Any future for us is purely theoretical.
Joss stared at her. Somehow, he retained enough muscle control to close his gaping mouth.
Tulk said, "You know the Bruvian saying? Ka'uta Valoman?" He shook his head.
"Seize the moment. It's all we have. The past is gone. The future may never arrive. What exists is now.
I'm not asking for marriage, Joss. I know that you can't travel that path with me. But we could share what comfort we might have together here and now. Two people who care for each other. The future, if it comes, will attend to itself. As should we. Where's the harm in it?"
He shook his head again. I wish I could do that. I'm just not wired that way. I need to commit to something this important."
"Am I that important to you, Joss?"
He looked at her, and she smiled again. A sad smile.
"You needn't say it aloud. Your expression tells me."
She paused.
"All right, then. I'll be your friend and your co-worker, because it seems that's all we're allowed. More's the pity."
She reached out and touched his hand, and he felt an electric thrill run through his whole body. She withdrew her hand. She wasn't smiling now.
"Oops. I've contaminated you. Sorry. You'll have to wash your hands again. I'll see you in the OT.
When she was gone, he found that he was shaking. He had to get out. Not for long and not far, but he could not face the OT right now, especially with Tulk in it. He calmed Zan.
"You owe me," Zabrak said darkly as Joss watched him scrub up. "I just finished my own rotation 2 hours ago. Sleep's overrated."
"I wouldn't know."
"Just give me an hour or so," Joss said. "I've got to clear my head."
"So you're going for a walk? Have you been outside lately? The air's so thick you could swim to the cantina."
"1 hour," Joss said. "I'll be back."
He left the building and struck out across the compound, angling away from the marshes and toward the relatively drier Bota fields. He stepped through a small stand of broad-leaved trees, waving away the wing stingers and fire gnats swarming around him, and saw the Bota fields. He made no attempt to pinch off a bit of the plant, knowing that the rows were protected by a low-level zap field. This innocuous growth was a precious commodity. Understandable. Since its adaptogenic cells could serve a variety of purposes, everything from potent, broad-based antibiotic to hallucinogen to nutrient, depending on the species. If it could be cultivated off-world, it would give the spice traders considerable cause to worry, because it could literally be all things to all people. All things to all people. It suddenly seemed to Joss that he'd spent a goodly part of his life, entirely too much, perhaps, trying to be the same thing. As far back as he could remember, it had been assumed that he would be a doctor. It wasn't a decision he regretted. He was proud of his profession. But that was only one of many ways that he'd endeavored to be the good son. He studied hard,
always toed the line, been a child of whom anyone could be proud. And his family had been proud of him, no question of it. They had never stinted in their praise. He had no desire to hurt them or to see them hurt. And he knew that espousing an Exter would probably put them in early graves. It didn't take a Jedi to see that Tulk would shine out amid an entire planet full of women. And he couldn't deny that her offer of wartime comfort was tempting. Very tempting. But he couldn't. "What are you afraid of?" "I'm afraid I'll fall in love with her," he said aloud.
"I think it's too late to fear that," a gentle voice behind him said.
Startled, Joss turned, expecting for an instant to see Tulk, to wonder if he should be delighted, angry, afraid, or something for which he likely had no name. But it wasn't Tulk. It was the Padawan, Barriss Offee.
Barriss had been initially surprised to encounter Joss this far from the base. After a moment, however, she realized there was nothing to be surprised about. She had been wanting to talk to him, to offer him some solace for the mental and emotional turmoil she knew he was going through. It was not just her desire as a friend. It was her duty as a Jedi.
"You are troubled, Joss," she murmured. "You are fighting your own internal war on as many different fronts as the Republic is on Drongar. I can't solve your crises, but I can guide you to a more secure place from where you can deal with them."
"Why?" he asked. "I mean, what's so special about me?" Barriss smiled. "I could say I want to ensure your ability to perform well in the OT, and there is something of that in my purpose, but mostly it's because I'm a Jedi and a healer as well. My purpose is to aid and comfort."
Joss was silent for a moment. Then he said, "What did you mean when you said it was too late to fear falling in love with Tulk?"
"Exactly what I said. It's obvious you love her and she reciprocates. I would see it even without the Force's aid. If you don't believe me, ask any of your friends."
Joss lifted his arms in exasperation. "So everyone sees it but me?"
"One is usually blind when one is the eye of the storm.
But she's Exter," he whispered. "My family would be devastated."
"Most likely true.
I'd be giving up everything. My family, my friends, my practice. And for what?"
Barriss looked at him.
"For love," she said.
Joss was silent for several long